hello, and welcome to another episode of the MicroISV show here on Channel 9. I'm Michael Lehman, technology evangelist for the MicroISVs here at Microsoft, along with my co-host Bob Walsh, the author of Clear Blogging over at clearblogging.com, and MicroISV from Vision to Reality, and proprietor of a MicroISV, Safari Software. And today we have on the show Jessica Livingston, who has written a book called Founders at Work, in which she's gone out and interviewed a whole bunch of people that started startups and tried to figure out what's their secret sauce or what advice do they have. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. Did I properly characterize the subject and intent of your book?
Yes, you did.
All right. Awesome. All right, then. Without further ado, Bob, take it away.
Okay. Hi, Jessica. How you doing?
I'm great, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And, you know, the pleasure is anybody who picks up this book to read it, because you've got here 32 different interviews with basically some of the rich and famous of the micro-ISV world who've gone on to bigger and better things, like Steve Wozniak, Joel Krause, Mitchell Kapoor, better known as Mitch Kapoor, Ray Ozzie of Microsoft fame, the founders of just so many different applications that are out there and companies that have gotten just amazing influence over the course of where computers and software and, in fact, the entire world has gone. I guess my first question to you, as I read through these interviews and these people just basically tell all about what motivated them to get started, how they were able to overcome mistakes they've made, where things turned right for them, I just wonder, how were you able to do these interviews? Walk me through how you do a typical interview with these people.
Well, a typical interview I would do in person, and I think that makes a big difference when you're actually sitting down with someone, looking at them straight on. It really does help, and every single one I did in person except for the Research in Motion interview. I do not have a technology background, I should state for everyone, but I did try to do a lot of homework before I did the interviews to understand what was really unique and cool about these companies. And in a lot of cases, I asked some of my friends who were technologists, you know, what would you most like to know? So I did try to prepare. I had some questions that you'll notice if you read the book that I do ask in every single one. For instance, what surprised you most? When did you most want to quit, and why didn't you? Were you worried about your competition? But I did try to tailor it to each interview to really get out the most interesting stuff. And as far as getting people to open up, I think it's a hard question to answer. I think that's what really made the book. You touched on an important part, is these people were just so open about sharing some of their embarrassing moments from early on, and times that, you know, it might not be something they're super proud of, but looking back, I think as people reflect on how they got started in the early days, every single company makes mistakes. You always have embarrassing moments. You always have things you regret and wish you had done differently. And I think that because the founders were so open about it, it really sheds this light on this mysterious time of companies, which is in the first few years. If you haven't been there before, you don't really know what goes on. And I think the founders' candor really, really is the greatest thing about the book.
When you interviewed these founders in person, did anything come across as to what type of commonalities they had in terms of their personality or their outlook or just what sort of people they were?
Well, I did try to make a point of interviewing all different types of founders, different ages, different types. The one commonality that I found that cuts across everyone is just an amazing level of determination. These people all focused on making something people wanted and did not give up. And in every story, there are hardships, there are obstacles, there are moments when they thought they were dead, and they just kept going at times when most of us would have given up.
Well, that's not surprising, because in the interviews I've done with micro ISVs, I've seen the same thing. You have to have a lot of determination, a lot of perseverance. And a lot of times what's happened, and you bring this out very well in a lot of the interviews that you do, the entrepreneur starts with a goal of A, and along the way they realize, hey, wait a second, over here on B, I've got something that's much more valuable, much more interesting, and I'd rather really be doing that, and that's what they end up going with.
You are exactly right. That's actually one other commonality that I found, is kind of the mental flexibility that these founders all had, because as you read, most of these companies start off as one thing and turn into another. Flickr started off as an online game, and it wasn't until they figured out that the most popular part of that was this photo sharing feature that they had. It wasn't until they focused on that specifically that Flickr came about. PayPal originally started out doing encryption software. And you find that these companies in the early days go through tremendous changes, because sometimes it's not really until you implement an idea, especially if it's a new one, and especially if it's an idea that people think are crazy, it's not till you actually try it out that you see if it works. And so these companies, there was so much trial and error going on. That's one misperception that I think a lot of people have. They think that startups come out of some brilliant idea, like a plant grows from a seed. And in fact, it's not that way. It's a bunch of trial and error.
Well, the other thing I notice as kind of a theme running through this is that none of these people were the 30-minute instant fame and fortune success. A lot of these people worked many, many years to really get to be at that point where they got on the public stage, and then they became the instant success. Thinking about, for instance, Mina Trott, while bloggers knew who she was and Ben Trott were, no one else had the slightest clue this world existed for a good 6-7 years up until really right about now.
Well, I think that a lot of people who are doing new things, which, by the way, I think most all of the founders I interviewed were all doing something new, it takes a while to catch on. I mean, if you have a new idea, a lot of people are going to reject it at first because it's not something that they've done already, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the perseverance comes in. Most all of the founders, if they didn't get explicitly rejected, and there are many stories about rejection in these interviews, then it was the kind of thing where the mainstream wasn't aware of it and didn't embrace it, but these founders said, this is the right thing, this is a great idea, we're growing some users, and they just kept working through it until that kind of tipping point where the mainstream becomes aware of the idea and journalists are writing about you. But, you know, it's a long road to get to that point, and that's where the perseverance comes in handy.
Well, you know, another thing I'm wondering, has the road changed from the days when, you know, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs worked out of a garage, basically built hobby machines that turned into Apple I and Apple IIe, and all the way down to the point now where we have people out there who are much younger than the company that these people started? Have things changed for startups?
I think a lot in the environment has changed. I mean, you reference Wozniak and Jobs. Let's remember, they were building a personal computer before we all had a computer on our desk. So that's a pretty big deal. But I think a lot has changed since then that makes it a little bit easier for startup founders. I mean, now you have Specifically, I guess the changes involve salaries, servers, software, and promotion. You have the web. So the web has more good things that are out there can bubble up to the top, and good things that are out there have a way of making themselves known on the web. And you have bloggers, and you have ways of advertising that just didn't exist 30 years ago. You have open source software, so you have programming languages that are much more powerful than back 30 years ago, and you have servers and bandwidth that are a lot cheaper these days. So what it all boils down to is that in many ways, it's cheaper and a little bit easier to start startups. So you can be a couple guys in a garage with a good idea, especially if it's a software idea, and just test it out, throw it up on the web and see what happens, and iterate on it. I mean, back in the days with Steve Wozniak and Apple, I mean, it was very hard for them to advertise, and they had to basically get the computer in the store to let people know about it. And I think that that's just changed dramatically these days. But what I think hasn't changed is that the whole idea of coming up with a new idea and making something that people want. It's still just as difficult to make something that users are going to actually find useful and use. And if it's a new idea, people will reject it until you get enough users and there's enough momentum that people say, okay, maybe I could use that. So I think they are facing some of the same problems, but it's a lot easier, I think, for people now.
Well, Jessica, having been there at that time and having done it, I can absolutely agree with you. It's a lot easier. The process of developing on those old microprocessors with the tools that we had was quite the experience. But still, I think one of the things, as you said, that there are still some things that are still the same, and one of those is how to actually communicate what you're doing to your users, and also how to find, you know, your users in the first place to make sure that you're actually building something that people want to come and buy. From your experience of talking with all the people you spoke with, what do they think about the whole sort of product planning and marketing process now versus then?
The marketing process is a little bit easier now because of the web, and you can get the word out a lot more easily, and you have tons of bloggers that are just as influential as getting a press hit in the Wall Street Journal. You don't have to raise millions and millions of dollars from venture capitalists to cover expensive PR promotion and billboard advertising, and so in that sense, it's a little bit different. The other thing that sort of the consequence of that is that more programmers and developer types, I think, can start companies, or they can start successful companies. Even back in the bubble, I think you always had to have a business person on your team so that you could raise money with venture capitalists. You know, I think that hackers are amazing at a lot of things. Maybe negotiating with investors isn't their top quality. But I think now because the marketing's a lot easier to do, or it requires less money, I think that programmers can more easily develop startups and get the word out and get people using it virally a lot more easily than in the past.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. However, you know, there's still, I'd be interested to know what you found in your interviews. One of the things that practically everyone we've talked to about MicroISV process has said, while it's technically possible to do it on your own, mm-hmm. it always really, you have a much better chance of success when you have a partner, even if the partner isn't technical, or even if both people are technical, you don't have to try to wear all the hats on top of one head. Do you have any wisdom from the people you spoke with about doing it on your own versus doing it with a partner?
Well, you'll notice that most of the founders that I interviewed did have a co-founder. Joshua Schachter of Delicious did it on his own for quite some time. But most people in that I interviewed had co-founders, and that speaks to the fact that it's the startup, starting a startup and bringing it to the point where you have a lot of users, it's a hard, lonely process. And to go through it alone and to have to be everything to everyone is very difficult. To have at least one other person who can balance things out, to have someone who you can bounce ideas off of, to have someone else who can handle things while you're dealing with the servers that are on fire, I think that most everyone will say, find a co-founder, find someone that you trust implicitly before you get started with things.
You know, one thing I wondered, because I don't think this was anything that you did, but I think it's just a reflection of what's out there. I only see two women out of the 32 people here. I could be wrong, but I think that's 32 out of 32. Why are there so few women startups? Is it there are just so few women programmers?
Well, as a woman, that's something that I think about a lot. There are actually three interviews in this, Anne Winblad, Mina Trott, and Katarina Fake, out of the 32. And let me tell you, it was hard to find those three. I wanted to find more, but there aren't that many female founders of technology startups. And I think one of the main reasons is that there are fewer programmers that are female. But it's a really tough question. I'm not sure why there aren't more. I think that the trend is shifting. I think there are becoming more and more females who are actually going out and founding startups. But there's still a lot of room to go.
Well, there, Heidi Rosen might be a name that rings a bell. Back in the 80s, early 80s, she started a company with her brother called TeaMaker. For a long time, she was really about the only female software executive founder out there. And I guess I'm surprised that it's still rare today.
Yeah, I like I said, I do think about this a lot, and I wonder why there aren't more females. I mean, you do find that females might be some of the early employees, but they aren't the actual founders. And I don't know. I mean, I'd love to. I'm writing a volume 2 for Founders at Work, and one of my goals is to try to find more females.
Well, that's a natural lead-in for my next question, which is, who would you like to interview, or maybe who have you interviewed for volume 2?
Well, I have not interviewed anyone yet, because Founders at Work just came out a month ago, and I'm trying to relax for at least a month before I get started. But
there you go.
There are just so many other founders. One of the lessons that I learned from interviewing these 32 is that every person has their own story to tell and their own advice. You can find very useful information from every single interview in this book. It's really a fund of experience for people to learn from. And so there are so many other founders that I'd love to get their perspective from. Ideally, you know, I got to shoot high. I'd love to talk to Larry or Sergey and find out about Google in the early days and ask them some questions. So that would kind of be a dream. I'd love to interview the founders of YouTube to find out, you know, how did they first get their users? What was it like for them? I'd also like to interview some founders of companies that might have failed and find out why did it fail? What went wrong? Because in most all of the interviews in Founders at Work, you'll find that there were some really near-death experiences for these companies. I mean, blogger Evan Williams had to let every single person at his company go, and the next day he was the only person at work. I mean, talk about depressing. Mm-hmm. And he came back. He brought it back from life, and it was acquired by Google. But there might be cases out there where a company didn't come back from the dead, and I'd be interested to know why.
You know, I don't know if you can find those people today. They may have moved on and don't really want to talk about it, but I hope you do, because the one thing that I see as I read through this is none of these people had their success handed to them on a silver platter. They really fought hard to be successful. But one thing I do notice is sort of Jim's fingerprints sort of all over the history of this. And by Jim, I mean J-Y-M, Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. About a dozen of these have been acquired by one or the other of those three companies. And I'm curious, what do you think of acquisitions, and what happens to the founders after they've been acquired?
Well, I think that a lot of the founders, if they get acquired, they find that just life is not exactly the same. It is a beautiful time in a company when you are in this micro ISV stage and you're just a few people, you are changing the idea, you're working around the clock, you don't have to get anyone's approval to do anything, and then you're really the most productive you are in your entire life. And then you get acquired into a bigger company, and a lot of these founders who I interviewed had difficult times with that. They're suddenly part of a big organization, and they have to get sign-off from people, and they have to go through layers of meetings, and that's just is counterproductive for them. And I think big businesses could learn a lot from that, by the way. They could learn different ways to be more productive. But back to your question, how do these founders feel? James Currier described it well in his interview. He's the founder of Tickle, which was acquired by Monster, and he actually stayed on for several years to make sure the acquisition was successful and had a really good experience with Monster.com. But he said there are certain people who are starters, and those people just have to be doing new things. And I think it's true with most of the people I interviewed. You will find that a lot of them went on to do something just as ambitious as their first startup. Joe Krause of Excite went on again with Graham Spencer to do a company, JotSpot, which was recently acquired by Google. A lot of these people have gone on to do. Rayazi, you know, went on to do Groove Networks after he did Iris Associates, and so they don't stop. They're not in it for the quick riches. They're not in it just to be a one-time success. They want to start different things, and it's kind of in their blood. One other thing that I'd like to say, I forgot to mention one of my other dream interviews would be with Bill Gates. So if you guys have any pull, that would be great.
So, Jessica, you have another thing beyond the book that you're working with, the Y Combinator. And I know that micro ISVs are always thinking about, you know, their own sort of both startup process and potentially exit strategy. Because, as you said, some people are sort of serial starters of things. And not everybody necessarily who has a great idea who wants to found a company wants to run a company over the long term. So tell me a little bit about what you do with that and how that thinking process might apply to somebody who wants to start a company in this new day and age.
Well, at Y Combinator, we invest in early stage companies, and we invest twice a year in batches, which is pretty unique because we'll invest in, say, 13 startups at a time. Usually there are two or three people that just have an idea. It's so early stage that we help them incorporate, and we give them all sorts of technical advice, and we help them with some of their legal things. And we create this community in this 3 months where we have weekly dinners where we bring in guest speakers to educate them about sort of the business side of starting startups. And we found that we've invested in 39 companies so far, and many have gone on to grow bigger and have had VC funding, and some have had angel funding. But we found that it's a really great community for these startups to work in, because when you're just two people in an apartment, it can be really lonely. And suddenly to have this community of 40 other startups doing the same thing as you and having the mentorship of my three partners and I, my three partners are Paul Graham, Robert Morris, and Trevor Blackwell, who founded ViaWeb back in the 90s that was acquired by Yahoo. They spend a lot of time with the groups, counseling them on their strategy and on marketing and on their technology, and we give them just small amounts of money, enough to pay the rent for a few months, basically, until they can get more funding. But it's a nice way, if you're thinking about getting started and you're feeling a little unsure because you've never done it before, Y Combinator is a nice way to go.
Where were you 5 years ago?
Where was I 5 years
Well,
ago?
The reason I'm asking that is because prior to coming to Microsoft, one of the things I did after the crash was do a startup with a co-founder of a startup called RightPage, and that is exactly the kind of process, services, thinking, assistance that would have just been absolutely priceless to us at the time. So I can certainly speak from personal experience that those kind of things, if anybody out there is thinking about doing a startup, you know, investigate this, take advantage of any way you can to get that kind of assistance, because you can think of a great idea, but getting all of those other things done and also getting them to do it within sort of some sort of a group setting would just be absolutely huge.
Yeah, we found that most of the people that go through our programs, they might not have done it otherwise. We've completely helped them in ways that they didn't even think that they'd encounter. Again, we're talking about the early days of companies where most people who haven't done it before don't know what to expect. And we've sort of been through it, so we try to offer some good advice for people.
Well, and even people who have done it before, to be able to have a community of people to go through that process with would be really, really valuable.
Yeah, it helps a lot, and it's actually one of the best parts about the program that we find is this wonderful community of people who are all in it together, helping each other out.
I guess I'm wondering something, though, which is for the lucky 40 that get started together, that works out great, but there's thousands and thousands of want-to-be micro ISVs out there. I'm wondering if you see the day that there'll be more of an online micro ISV community than we already have.
Oh, yes. Oh, I think this is already starting, Bob. I think that there are a lot of websites out there. There's one by Mark Fletcher of Bloglines, who I interviewed for the book. He just launched a community website, well, a website called startupping.com, that it's all about how do you get legal advice, where do you find other founders. It's a community for startups. And I think, you know, Y Combinator has just launched a few weeks ago a news site where people submit, it's kind of like a Reddit or Dig, where people submit stories related to startup news and they get voted up and down. And there are just all of these websites cropping up to help people who want to educate themselves and network and belong to something. When they're just two people working in that apartment, they want some sort of a community. And I think that there are these things cropping up now to help that.
Well, I have to add just a small little plug here for Joel on Software, the Business of Software Forum, which has been going for a good number of years, and where like-minded micro ISVs and startups hang out. And it's amazing how good the quality of the information is, because people are very willing to share information there. And I guess one thing that I notice here, kind of looking long-term, at least in the United States and perhaps more in Europe as well, the idea of a startup has become much more culturally accepted, in the same way that the idea of being self-employed has become much more socially acceptable. And I'm wondering, do you see that as well from the people that you've talked to and basically the things they've gone through?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at actually some of the interviews, that two stick out in my mind. There's one with Brewster Kahle, who said when he was first starting Waze, He felt like a complete outsider, and he moved. One of the best parts about moving to California was that he suddenly didn't feel different for starting his own company. And Winblad, when she started her startup called Open Systems, said that she felt like an alien. She couldn't even describe to her family what she was doing because they wouldn't understand. And I think now, starting your own company is becoming so much more socially acceptable. People get it. People understand what a startup is, and they don't think you're weird or doing something insane. You get a lot of college graduates who say, rather than going to work for a big company, I have this great idea, and I think I'm gonna try starting a startup. And you'll find the parents don't say, you're making the worst decision of your life. We've definitely found that with a lot of the people who apply to get funding from Y Combinator. We worry sometimes about what their parents are going to think, because for many of them, they're in their early 20s. And we found that it's just much more socially acceptable now to start a startup.
Well, it's the tip of the iceberg, I think, because if you go out there and you take a look at what people are doing now when they start companies. I'm not talking about technological companies. I'm talking about just companies. They are doing the stuff that programmers and high-tech people were doing sort of cutting edge back, let's say, 6, 7, 8 years ago. They're distributed companies. They don't have hierarchies. They are very focused on what their customers want. They don't go for the traditional marketing and advertising. There's a real sea change going on here. And I guess these people were, in a lot of ways, sort of the guiding lights and beacons of light out there. And it just amazes me, the level of detail and information that you were able to elicit from these people. For instance, when you were talking with David Heinzemeier Hansen, who I never can now pronounce his middle name correctly, the man behind Ruby on Rails, one of the founders of what is now 37 Signals as a software company, he goes into a lot of detail about how he actually came to see the world and how that reflected in Backpack, and I'm sorry, Basecamp, and how it really influenced his whole development process. This is stuff you just cannot get anywhere else. I'm wondering, what other stories kind of stick in your mind from the first book?
Well, that's sort of like asking which is your favorite child. I have to say there, but there are a lot of great stories in the book, and I tend to like ones that are kind of illustrative of the pain and the absolute mayhem that is involved in the early days of startups. There are some really funny stories that people were willing to share with me. And just on a side note, I'll mention that a lot of these people who I interviewed were kind of reflecting back on the companies, and they're no longer a part of them anymore. They were either acquired or whatever, and I think it makes it easier to sort of share those stories. But some of my favorites, there's one that I laugh at every time I read, by James Hong of Hot or Not. And of course, his company took off in a matter of days. He just started it as sort of a fun thing to do with his friend Jim. And it got 40,000 hits on its first day. And they were suddenly faced with all sorts of scaling problems and bandwidth issues, and they had to solve a lot of problems very quickly. He said he only slept 8 hours in the first 8 days of when they launched the site. And one of the problems they were having was with pornography and people uploading, you know, naked pictures of themselves, and they wanted to keep the site clean, or they knew they'd never be able to get advertising. So James asked his retired parents to sort of moderate the site and make sure people weren't spamming it or doing anything they shouldn't. And the parents agreed, and after a few days, James checked in with his parents, who, by the way, I have to say, he described his father as a 60-year-old retired Chinese guy who, as his father, was supposed to be asexual. And he said, "How's it going, Dad?" And the father said, "Oh, it's fine. You know, Mom saw some interesting pictures of a man and a woman and another woman doing this." And James just went back to his co-founder and said, "Dude, we can't do this anymore. My parents are looking at porn all day." And I love that story because it just shows you how insane some of the things are that crop up that you would just never plan to see when you start a startup. Although that's sort of a more funny story. There are other stories that really have you at the edge of your seat. Do we have time for me to tell one more quickly? There's one actually from Web TV that doesn't get talked about a lot, but I love it, which was, of course, acquired by Microsoft. Steve Perlman, the founder, it was very important for them to have a deal with a manufacturer, and they landed a deal with Sony to manufacture their device and distribute it. And as soon as they landed that deal, they then got interest from a venture capitalist, which, by the way, was very hard for them to do because no one at the time felt that people would want to interact with the internet on their television. So they got this investor that was interested, and the day they were supposed to sign the paperwork to get $4.5 million of funding, they got a certified letter from Sony saying, "After due consideration, we've decided not to go through with our deal anymore." So they were devastated, and they told their investor, who said, "You know, I really believe in you guys, and we're going to go forward with funding on the same terms," which was great for them. So they had been working with a guy who had a relationship with the CEO of Sony, and so they said, "Can you look into why Sony dropped us?" So the guy called the CEO, who happened to be in New York with his CTO, and the CEO said, "Oh, we're not convinced the technology works, but I'll send my CTO out today on a jet to come look at Web TV." So this intermediary calls Steve Perlman and says, "Okay, the CTO, you've got your chance. He's coming to look at the demo of Web TV. You better make sure it works." And so Steve says, "Great, when's he coming?" And the guy says, "When is he coming? I said he's been dispatched. He'll be there in 2.5 hours. So this just set off this whirlwind at Web TV because they had been in the process of developing this, and there were all these bugs in the system. They were in the middle of a build, which was going to take 2.5 hours. Steve said, "Oh, God, we have no choice. We're going to have to go with, you know, we're going to have to go with the build when it's done." And so the CTO arrives, and they try to bide some time by feeding him some vegetables and crackers. And finally the CTO says, "Look, I got to look at your software. I'm in a rush here." So Steve looks over at his co-founder and says, "Okay, we're ready to go." And he sort of whispers, "How did the build go? Did you test it?" And the co-founder says, "Test? This is a test." So they were rolling it out in front of the CTO and hadn't even tested it. And, you know, it just miraculously worked, and it was perfect, and they got the deal with Sony. But it just goes to show you how half of what you're doing is just flying by the seat of your pants and not planning for much and hoping that it works out.
You know, that's a great story. And as I look at these people, I think about the stories they've told you. You know, it's not about the money. It's about the passion. And I keep coming back and looking at things that these people have said. And it's always been taught sort of in our culture that, you know, you focus on the money, you go get the business, you find what's profitable. You know, you do your business plan, you draw within the lines, and you know, be a good developer, soldier, corporate person type person. These people blew all that out the door, and they were really all about the passion they had. Do you think that passion is like one of the meta themes that comes through as you do these interviews?
Oh, absolutely. And passion, you know, can also be, I sometimes translate it into sometimes I use perseverance instead, but it is the whole concept of passion and just not, these guys were not in it for the money. I mean, yes, they liked the financial freedom that came along with having a liquidity event, but they really were passionate. They were out there to change the world. They were trying to fix something that was broken or do something new. And you have to be that way because you are going to get so many people who tell you that your idea is a bad one. Sabir Bhatia of Hotmail, he was rejected over and over. People just dismissed the idea of web-based email as unpromising. Can you imagine life now without web-based email? And so I think you have to have a passion that keeps you going through all of the hard times and through the times when most people would quit, most people would give up, but these guys all had something special about them that kept them going, and I think you're right, passion is one of the main things they all have.
You know, to kind of close things out here, I can certainly corroborate that. In fact, when I started my one successful startup, it actually started because I had just finished a number of big projects and really enjoyed that feeling of having created something out of nothing, and actually spent a whole bunch of time just trying to sit around saying, I really want to have something that I really want to do, and, you know, how do I find that next thing that I just won't let go of? And, you know, so that's, I think, a really crucial part of it, that starting a startup is not about getting rich. In fact, there's an old adage I've said on the show before, that the way to make a small fortune in the software business is start with a larger one. And I think that probably more often than not, that's true. But if you add that other ingredient in there that you really want it to succeed, and especially I think that the thing you mentioned before, and if you're willing to have it morph into something other than what you originally intended, as you mentioned about PayPal and Flickr, that you can actually, you know, make something out of it. So if you were to try to, this is sort of a final question, you know, look at all the different people that you spoke to. You know, is there one common attribute other than their tenaciousness? I mean, obviously they come from all different walks of life and all different ages and so forth. Mm-hmm. If somebody wanted to start a startup, you know, what would be the thing they would want to find in themselves?
I think they'd want to find in themselves a mental flexibility that allowed them to make something that people want. Because your startup is not going to be successful unless you make something that users want, that they use. It could be a brilliant idea, but if no one uses it, it's going to fail. So you have to be able to stray from your original idea to allow you to do that a lot of the time.
Well, that makes great sense. All right. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the MicroISV show.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you both.
Is there a website for the book?
Yes. You can go to foundersatwork.com to check it out, and I'll probably be posting another interview in the next couple weeks, so you can check that out. The Wozniak interview and Joel Spolsky's interview are on that site at this time.
Awesome. All right, well, that's it for this edition of the MicroISV show here on Channel 9. I'm Michael Lehman, technology evangelist for Microsoft, and you can check out what we're doing for MicroISVs at projectsglidepath.net, along with my co-host Bob Walsh, and you can check out his new book, Clear Blogging, at clearblogging.com, and his MicroISV at safarisoftware.com. And again, Jessica, thank you so much, and we'll see everybody next time on the MicroISV show here on Channel 9.